From WAMU 88.5 at American University in Washington, welcome to the Politics Hour. I'm Mark Fisher, sitting in for Kodjo Namdi. Tom Sherwood is our resident analyst. He's a contributing writer for Washington City Paper. Good to see you, Tom.
Good afternoon, everyone.
And we will be talking later this hour with Democrats and Republicans about the gun debate that ended as abruptly as it started in Virginia earlier this week as the GOP-controlled legislature took the narrative away from Virginia's Governor Ralph Northam. This was quite a scene in which we had one man shouting from the gallery of the House of Delegates, "Gutless bastards," not exactly the kind of language one hears in the Virginia legislature terribly often. That's coming up later this hour. But first, we're also joined by Mary Che, the Ward 3 District of Columbia Council member. Welcome.
Thank you very much. Happy to be here.
No cursing.
And there'll be no cursing and there'll be no gun shooting or anything like that. But there are some difficult issues and some internal issues that have kept the D.C. Council busy this week. A federal grand jury investigating D.C. Council member Jack Evans from Ward 2 has now issued subpoenas for testimony and documents related to an inquiry in which a committee of Metro found that Evans had committed ethical misconduct when he was chairman of that transit agency's board of directors. That's the latest development in an ongoing matter that has once again put the spotlight on a council that has had ethical and corruption issues through the years. And Tom, is this kind of more of the same, or is it an aberration in what has become an otherwise smoothly functioning council?
It's not an aberration. Since the early 2000s, there have been five new council members who've come to the council in the wake of some kind of unethical doing, or in one of those cases, Vincent Orange leaving, having been defeated in the primary, and then trying to get the job as head of D.C. Chamber of Commerce while remaining a council member. But there, unfortunately, for a very small body of 13, when as many as four or five have had some problems, it is an issue for the city, both practically and in its image.
It's not a good percentage. Mary Che, this latest news about the federal grand jury investigating Jack Evans now issuing subpoenas for witness testimony, does that mean we're going to be living with this situation for some months to come?
Well, we're inevitably going to be living with it for some months to come, either from the perspective of the U.S. attorney and the grand jury, or from the council itself, because before our summer break, and we won't come back until September 15th, the chairman of the council will engage a law firm to investigate ethical or conflict of interest allegations against Mr. Evans on the council.
Going back to January 2014.
That's right. And there was some notion that we should go back even further because Councilmember Grasso did some research and found out that Mr. Evans had never recused himself since 2009, even though he's had these relationships with law firms and clients and so on since then, during that time. But in any case, so that's going to happen over the summer. And then when we come back, the chairman said he's going to appoint a special committee to receive the findings and to act on it from there. So we have months in front of us.
Councilmember Che, the council moved this week to remove your colleague, Jack Evans, the most senior member of the council, as chair of the powerful Finance and Revenue Committee. And the council is also hiring an outside law firm to investigate him. Why did you conclude that this action was necessary? And what are your concerns about what this does to the council's reputation?
Well, I'm very concerned about it, and that's what happens. Sometimes people, see the council monolithically, and somebody gets in trouble, and so it washes back on all of us. So it's very, very troubling. But as to these events, first of all, there was an action taken by the council in March in response to Washington Post reports and other media reports revealing emails that Mr. Evans used to try to solicit a law firm to hire him, where he flat out stated that he was going to use his influence on the council and on the WMATA board in behalf of their clients, and used government resources, to do this. And that's what we had in front of us at that point. And at that point, we didn't know that this was just, the tip of the iceberg. And so we met about that part of his committee was taken away dealing with certain financial matters. And also he was reprimanded, which is a lower...
The lowest
punishment that we can apply, saying that we were willing to await the U.S. Attorney's investigation and any other developments, whether it be from the Board of Elections and Ethics, et cetera. But then when the WMATA matter broke, and it also implicated various counsel issues, we had to jump back in. And that was what you just saw recently, taking away his chairmanship.
And you said that in all this time you, at some level, didn't know the details of what he'd been doing. And yet you've served with him for quite some years. And he has always been involved with important members of the business community. He's always had a consulting business and legal work on the side of his counsel employment. Did you have concerns during the earlier parts of your tenure together with him that what he was doing was not quite proper?
There were always, you know, rumors or that sort of thing. But we, most of us felt, because he was senior and sophisticated, that he knew where the line was and wouldn't step over it.
And very publicly was pro-business, with building baseball stadiums or anything else, or trying to get the skins back. He's been very pro-business publicly, so it's not a surprise.
Right, that wasn't a surprise. But I had always thought, anyway, that he was dealing straightforwardly with colleagues and with me, things that he told me. Looking back, I realized that that was not necessarily the case.
You said in the Metro matter, you said that you were, quote, rooting for Jack, unquote, to explain himself.
Well, yes,
clearly you decided he didn't.
No, he didn't. But I was rooting for him because he said, and he told me, that he was cleared, that he didn't do anything wrong, and that it would all be explained. So I said, yes, good, go. I wanted him to be cleared. But as you said, Tom, it not only was he not cleared, he dug a much deeper hole for himself.
Do you feel personally betrayed?
I do.
Mm-hmm. Have you told him that?
I have, and I've also stated that publicly.
And did he respond?
Well, you know, just by way of an illustration, even at Tuesday's meeting, I said to him, because I sit next to him, and I knew what was coming, and it was all very tense and everything. So just to be light about it, I brought up something, and I spoke to him. He said, oh, you're talking to me? He said, I thought you'd be really mad at me. I said, well, I am really mad at you, but I'm asking you this little, you know, nonsensical thing. But so he knows.
We should note that we invited Jack Evans to appear on this program, and he declined.
So the council took away his chairmanship of the Finance and Revenue Committee, and he didn't go to New York this week with the mayor and the, for bond issues. But the council declined Councilmember Grasso's move to remove Jack Evans from every committee that he serves on as a member. It also declined to force the chairman to appoint an ad hoc investigative committee that would meet during the summer along with the law firm. And I'm just wondering if that's, I think you voted for both of those things to.
Yes, take the issue of the other committees that he serves on. One of them is business and economic development. And much, not all, but much of the financial stuff, including the CFO and the administration of the lottery contract and Office of Tax and Revenue and a whole lot of other financial matters have been essentially reconstructed in business and economic development
under Kenyon McDuffie.
Yes, on which Jack Evans serves. So it seems inevitable to me that there will be issues where, even though he's said he's dissolved his consulting firm, where there will be, you know, the continuing, if you will, forgive me, paybacks to those who helped him.
You're listening to The Politics Hour. I'm Mark Fisher, sitting in for Kodjo Namdi. We're talking with Tom Sherwood and with Ward 3 Councilmember Mary Che. Let's hear from Melvin in Ward 5. Melvin, you're on the air.
Good afternoon. Well, first of all, I'd like to give Mary Che credit because she voted in the right direction. She's always voted conscious and in integrity. The members of the city council cannot police themselves. The actually outrageous behavior allowing Jack Evans to vote on the contract for the lottery was disgraceful, especially after it was clear that he had colluded with his friends to get this lottery deal passed. They cannot police themselves. Everybody understands now it's a pay-for-play in D.C. Nothing has changed. Oversight is impossible. with these people because they always look out for their political interests. And it showed that the bloc that voted to support Evans and the lottery deal, all of them ought to resign for a lack of integrity and a lack of honesty and a lack of oversight.
So Mary Che, here is a district voter painting you all with that broad brush, and Jack Evans' actions do reflect on everyone else.
Well, yes, they do. But to focus on this lottery contract issue first, I had asked...
We're talking about the sports betting contract.
Yeah, I'm sorry. The sports betting.
Yes, just to be clear. The lottery.
No, I'm sorry. The sports bet, but the lottery contract was extended also as part of that. But in any case, I had asked, I cited the rules, and I cited the fact that Jack Evans was advantaged by his relationship with William Jarvis, who was his registered agent for his consulting company and provided legal services and so on, and so could be considered an associate. Mr. Jarvis was the lobbyist for Intralot, who got the contract for sports betting. And so that was a direct, for me, occasion for one to recuse oneself. So I had asked that he recuse himself, and he said simply no. When he was asked again by another council member, he just said no. He should have recused himself.
And that
himself.
Vote to approve the sole source contract with Intralot, which is a Greek gaming company. This is the contract to manage a quite lucrative online sports betting and lottery program here in the nation's capital. This was a 7-5 vote. So Jack Evans' vote was potentially decisive. And he, as you say, would not recuse himself from any of the votes having to do with his future on the council or from this vote regarding Intralot. Do you think this is a larger problem for the council in how it handles recusals? I mean, should a member be able to vote on his own punishment?
I know. And in fact, you know, in the breakfast which precedes the legislative session, where I put this question to him and he refused to recuse himself, I then turned to the chairman and I said, you know, my reading of the rules, and you can confirm this or not, we can't force anyone to recuse him or herself. And the remedy is after the fact, if somebody has not recused oneself and violated ethical rules, well, then you bring an ethics charge or something. I mean, it's wholly unsatisfactory.
Will you move to change the rules?
I hadn't thought about that. I have a more immediate thing that I'd like to change, which relates to the sports betting contract, and that's how we deal with subcontractors. That's the hidden world of deal making, apparently, because we give a big contract to one big company, and then they go around and they get subcontractors.
This is not the first time the city has given what some call a sweetheart deal to this same company, Intralot. They've been highly controversial in the past. And here again was a case where something that you would think there would be competitors out there who, I mean, this is a burgeoning business around the country, sports betting. It's about to break open in a big way in Virginia and Maryland, perhaps, as well as in the district. Why the rush to give all that money? This is a $215 million five-year deal to one company that's not even based here.
Well, we were sold a bill of goods by the chief financial officer and others who were interested in this. We were told, and the chief financial officer sat in my office at some length and other council members and was officially in touch with the council, said that we needed to have a sole source contract. A sole source contract, just giving it to one company, you don't have to bid, nothing's out there, you just give it to them. Is the exception. It's only, you know, really in unusual circumstances. And so the unusual circumstances that were portrayed was that we had to act right away because Maryland and Virginia were, you know, at the ready. And if we didn't get the first jump and therefore identify people who would bet with us and get their allegiance, we stood to lose millions and millions and millions of dollars.
So we had $50 million.
We had to hurry. And then second, we were told, I think, inaccurately, the kinds of money that would be involved and what we would get back. And then finally, there was a notion, and I supported this, that the money should be earmarked to the NEAR Act, which is a crime measure, crime prevention measure, and also to the Birth to Three program for, you know, helping to provide programs for birth to three children. However, the way the contract was drafted, it turns out that very little of that money would have been so divided, and it would have all gone, or much of it would have gone, for the app services to the general revenue, which could then be
used by the mayor.
Right.
Let me ask a general question about Jeffrey DeWitt, because he is the CFO. He came in and replaced Nat Gandhi several years ago. He has been, I think, been given pretty high remarks marks on keeping track of the city's $15 billion budget. Has this sports lottery contract damaged him to the degree that you think the city ought to consider maybe someone else? He's an independent CFO, so you can't just fire him for any reason. But is Mr. DeWitt, has he severely damaged himself here?
I'm not sure. I mean, he has done a good job overall, but there have been other, cracks in his armor as well. For example, he carried the water on the Intralot contract, and I think misrepresented, if not intentionally, but nevertheless did, what was at stake. He's also been far more favorable to interpreting the cost of programs that the council wants, making it more expensive for them to get them. He's been reluctant to provide information to committees about expenses. He seems to be, putting a thumb on the scale in favor of executive action, and he's supposed to be independent.
We should note that Mary Che voted against that Intralot contract and also voted to ask Jack Evans to recuse himself from voting on that contract, and that Maryland and Virginia, despite the argument that the district had to rush through this sole source contract because Maryland and Virginia were hot on the heels of the district, they're not actually going anywhere anytime soon.
They defaulted.
We're not, for those eager to see sports betting, it's not coming right away.
But so the foundations for giving the sole source contract fell away. And then on top of that, which made it so much worse, when the Washington Post revealed who the subcontractors were, and there were these, cronies and insiders and people who had very little or no experience in gaming, and one of whom even was a lobbyist for Intralot to get the sole source contract, it became completely untenable.
The chairman, very quickly, the chairman Mendelson, who pushed very hard for this and exchanged, some say, votes to get this, says that the city has a contract with Intralot. Who Intralot subcontracts with is not the city's business unless there's something illegal about it. He says, and if you go out to competitive bidding, these same subcontractors will be engaged in the same politics in a competitive bidding situation, and you'll be years behind in getting sports betting.
But it would be competitive, and it would be transparent, and it would be open. And, I thought the chairman's statement about all of this was extremely cynical. Well, these are the insiders. It could be worse. It's going to be even worse if we try again. And I said, okay, maybe the council doesn't review the subcontracts, but this one is put right in our face, and we can't pretend we don't see what everybody else can see, and we should have acted on it.
We have a message from Ronnie who wants to know from Councilmember Che who's behind the efforts to recall Jack Evans and whether she supports these efforts. In addition, we had at-large Councilmember David Grosso calling for Jack Evans to resign, saying it would, quote, save us all a lot of headache. The Gertrude Stein Democratic Club has also asked him to step down, but you're not calling for him to resign. Is that right?
No, I do want things to proceed in an orderly fashion, and he is entitled in our investigation to have his opportunity to speak up. As far as the recall, though, Jack Evans represents Ward 2. His voters elected him. If his voters decide to recall him, or if they turn him out of office because he's up next in the cycle, that's up to them. So that will be their vote.
And there's an effort. They only have a few thousand out of the 5,000. About 1,000 or so signatures out of the 5,000 they need to force a recall election.
Well,
so far, but they say they're going to get the votes. We could have a recall election this fall. Jack Evans has said to people clearly he doesn't intend to resign. And we all are already waiting for what happens next with the U.S. Attorney's Office. That's the big fish in this whole game.
Well, they better hurry up because the rules say that you can't do a recall in the first year of someone's term or in the last year. So as we go
running out of time.
As you go to 2020, they better have their signatures all together by then.
Mary Che is the Ward 3 District of Council, District of Columbia Council member. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
And Tom and I will be back after a short break. I'm Mark Fisher of the Washington Post sitting in for Kojo. When we come back, we'll talk about guns in Virginia and a whole lot more. Welcome back to the Politics Hour. I'm Mark Fisher, sitting in for Kodjo Namdi, and we'll be joined momentarily by Adam Eben, a member of the Virginia Senate, as we discuss the short-lived gun special session of the Virginia legislature. But first, Tom Sherwood, the resident, our resident analyst and contributing writer for Washington City Paper, a brief journey into Maryland, where there's been a big fight over small apartments in Montgomery County. This is a case where a proposal to relax some of the rules about how densely people can live together is running into some real problems. It's a classic battle really over gentrification and over just how urban the county wants to be.
This is a housing issue in jurisdictions across the urban areas across the country. Hans Reimer, the council member, wants to change zoning so that in single-family zoning areas, you may have an accessory dwelling unit separate from the home in which you might be in. Of course, that has opponents just horrified that that could change the nature of neighborhoods, put strains on transportation and services. But the point, he says, is that we have a housing crisis in Montgomery County, and that we must make rooms available for family members who might want to live, a parent who might want to live in the same property where their children are, or where students or some people, or just people who need places to live. Housing is so expensive in Montgomery County, it's only getting more expensive, and this would be one way to do it. There's a vote on July the 16th as of now. But again, opponents think that this would disrupt neighborhoods. The whole issue here is how much can in urban areas can we have single-family zoning?
And how urban do we want our suburban areas to be, or how willing are the current residents of those areas to allow that increase in density? When Mary Che joined us earlier, we didn't have time to get to another development in the district, and that is over this emoluments lawsuit, where the D.C. Attorney General Carl Racine and Maryland's Attorney General Brian Frosch had sued President Trump, trying to argue that he was violating the Constitution's provision against corruption, known as the Emoluments Clause, by using his hotel and other properties to enrich himself. Why did the court say you can't have this lawsuit?
Well, they said that the two attorneys general did not have standing to bring the suit that they, and it was a scathing 30-page decision when the appeals court said that there was no remedy that the court could see at this, and that the attorneys general should not have brought this case, and that they had no real standing, that they had not been harmed, and that the two attorneys general had stretched the meaning of harm to local businesses that may have been affected.
And this was a unanimous ruling by a three-judge panel,
yes.
All of them appointed by Republican presidents.
Right, and of course, the House Democrats are pursuing this emoluments issue also.
Separately,
it may
right.
be in Congress, it might be more successful.
Okay, let's turn to Virginia now, where the legislature convened on Tuesday and adjourned 90 minutes later. A crisp bit of legislative action? Not quite. Actually, what happened was the Republicans simply refused to take part in the governor's effort to have there be a confrontation finally over where we stand on gun policy. We're joined now by Adam Eben. He's a member of the Virginia Senate, where he represents the 30th District, including parts of Alexandria, Arlington, and Fairfax counties. And Senator Ralph Northam's special session of the General Assembly did not go as planned. Should he have foreseen what the Republicans would do?
I had hoped, and I'm sure the governor had hoped, that the Republicans would come to the table and at least listen, take testimony, and hear bills. It's hard to know what they're going to do in Richmond. They used some parliamentary shenanigans to abdicate their responsibility.
Shenanigans?
We don't normally adjourn a session after 90 minutes and then the bills that are referred to committee not even being heard in committee.
Okay, they didn't go outside the rules. They used the rules.
They used the rules, but okay. They were quite...
Wasn't sure what shenanigans mean.
Well, I would say shenanigans in that not even hearing the bills that you've assigned to committees is a new precedent.
Before we get into the Republicans, Speaker Kirk Cox and others said that the murders in Virginia Beach on May 31st, within a week, The governor said he would call a special session, which was scheduled for this past week. And they said it was just grandstanding by the governor, who was trying to move the conversation away from his blackface issues, that he was just trying to influence the elections this fall, and that they didn't, and that they had, there was a bunch of bills being introduced of varying ways about gun control, but they just thought that this was so starkly political, they kind of indicated that they weren't going to do anything, and they control both houses, the Senate and the House.
Well, their reaction was starkly political. The governor, I think, rather than move away from something, was trying to move towards something, which is an honest discussion. A lot of times during the legislative session, when we bring these bills forward, whether they're for gun violence prevention or otherwise, there's not enough time, they say. 46-day session last year, they hear about 2 minutes of testimony on some of my bills, whether or others, bills for universal background checks, extreme risk protection orders, that sort of thing. And when we could have had a time to look at it, and that's what a special session is for, to really talk and hear the witnesses, that's when they adjourned the session until November 18th. They didn't close the session. They just said it's till after November, after the November
conveniently
elections.
Right after the election.
That's
right.
Very convenient, and it's also before any new majority would take office, so they could fill up judgeships with their choices rather than any newly elected majority.
We'll hear the Republican perspective on all this from the chairman of the Virginia Republican Party a little bit later in the program. Senator Adam Eben, as you look back now on this aborted session, do you think that Governor Ralph Northam's perhaps diminished stature or authority because of the whole blackface scandal made it more difficult for a session like this to accomplish anything, or would the Republicans have done this no matter what?
I think they would have done it no matter what. They're afraid of the issue. They're afraid of facing the fact that more than 90% of Virginians support comprehensive universal background checks. Even during the chaos that we had briefly during the session, we governed and we had to get a budget done. We got it done. We passed, I think, 800 bills regardless. He signed them. So whatever his personal popularity is at, we still govern. We still work together on most issues.
What the big issue here is that the Republicans have the most narrow of majorities in both the House and the Senate. All 140 seats of the Virginia legislature are up on November the 5th. If you were to see a good result and you saw the Democrats take over both those chambers, what would be the principal gun control, gun measure that you would want to see Virginia pass that can't get past the Republicans now?
Well,
is it universal background checks? I mean, can maybe tick off two or three of them?
Sure. One would be universal background checks. We know that we've had 32,000 purchases that were blocked since 2009 from people who failed them. That doesn't count people who bought them from someone who's not a federal licensed dealer. That could have been closed up. Additionally, extreme risk protection orders, which allows when you see evidence of an impending crime, someone who's going to do harm to themselves or others, allows them to the courts to intervene. But there's so many easy things, whether it's reporting a gun to a police, a gun that's been lost or stolen, or even letting localities regulate their municipal buildings as courtrooms are regulated in Virginia. So there's a lot that ought to make sense to us, but the NRA and the Virginia Citizens Defense League have an outsized influence.
It's a tough political battle, but you know in legislatures, you've been there long enough, and you know that you work out arrangements with other members across the aisle. You get things done in a nonpartisan, if possible, way. How severely is this year's election cycle and this gun issue, I'm waiting for abortion to raise its head, going to affect the tone and tenor of elections going forward?
Well, people are pretty dug in on this issue. Unfortunately, they won't give an inch on the other side. I think this is the number one issue for I think they'll both impact this year's election. Guns are among the number one issue, gun violence prevention. And abortion, people want the right to a safe and legal abortion. They might have some differences about the details, but when people see the threats being raised in other states, I think it actually helps those who want to protect a woman's right to choose at the ballot box.
But Senator Ebbendy, you've gotten a lot of pushback from gun rights advocates, including one of your colleagues, Senator Bryce Reeves of Spotsylvania. Senator Reeves told a recent rally of the NRA that your agenda, quote, means infanticide is coming, all the gun bills, we're going to lose the right to work. He also pointed out that you're the only openly gay senator in Virginia. Is this kind of personal attack standard behavior in Richmond, or is this something new?
It's not standard behavior in Richmond while we're there. Unfortunately, people are using anything they can to whip up their base to irrelevant factors, to whip up their base for electoral gain. I don't know, you know, my being gay might matter to people who are with the anti-gay groups, but to the gun groups, I don't know what it has to do with anything. So that was pretty disappointing.
Did you talk to Senator Reeves about it?
I spoke to him briefly the other day, and he apologized and said he shouldn't have done it. But I'm tired of after-the-fact apologies for things that people do that are wrong. I'm also concerned not so much for my own for being used, but for the level of public discourse. You know, name-calling... You know, I mean, it's just obvious. We can differ on the issues without getting personal.
And the Virginia General Assembly had taken great pride for decades in having that level of civility that where debates were about policy, and they were not personal.
The Virginia way.
The Virginia way. Is the Virginia way gone away?
No, but it's at the edges. It's being threatened at times. But generally, we work together in Richmond. Generally, we get things done even when we disagree. But we have seen a polarization, because the margins are so close in Richmond, both in the Senate and the House.
What are the lingering effects for the going into the November election? The lingering effects or the overt effects of both what Governor Northam's blackface issue, Lieutenant Governor Fairfax's sexual assault allegations, which he denies, and then Mark Herring, the Attorney General, Democratic Attorney General, admission of a blackface incident in his past. So how is that playing out? Governor McAuliffe, the former governor, came back out of the presidential campaign to campaign across the state and is continuing to campaign because he wants a strong Democratic victory this fall. How serious are all those playing in the background and as opposed to any personal insults that you've gotten?
Well, they certainly don't help my party, but I would say if the voters focus on the individual candidates, individual choices, the issues they care about, we're going to win. It doesn't help us not having as many principals on the campaign trail who are universally popular, but I'm really excited that former Governor McAuliffe is there. If anyone can campaign and take up the space of three people, it would be him.
As Tom mentioned, Lieutenant Governor Justin Fairfax has been pushing back against these allegations that he sexually assaulted two women. His lawyer now says that an unnamed witness can corroborate his defense in one of those incidents, and yet Fairfax is still refusing to participate in a public hearing about the accusations. What do you think of the way he's handled this scandal?
It's embarrassing to the state, and it should be embarrassing to him. He needs to see the handwriting on the wall. He needs to realize that he'll never be elected to another public office again or win a Democratic primary. And I understand
the
part.
Have you said that to him?
No, we asked him to resign and left it at that. The part, though, about the his public hearing, I think that these kind of matters should be settled in courts. If we have a public hearing, I don't know what the goal or the question is. You have two compelling witnesses, and we don't have a district attorney as they have in North Carolina and Massachusetts who are empowered to investigate allegations of sexual assault that occurred across state lines.
This is the Politics Hour. He has been telling, I think, the Post and also the Richmond Times-Dispatch, the Lieutenant Governor has said that this scandal has raised his profile. That he, I'm a little surprised he said it that way, but he said this scandal has raised his profile, that people have come up to him and said, we believe you, we want you to stay in there, we want you to run. I just don't know how much that anecdotal evidence means. And you're very active in the Democratic Party. Is there any support with him among the Democratic Party leaders that you know and talk to?
No, not among the leadership at all. I think that with anyone in public life, there's a danger when you believe your biggest fans. And when you're in politics, people say to you on day one when you get elected to the lowest office, gee, are you going to run for Congress? Are you going to run for president? Are you going to run for U.S. Senate? And people let it go to their head, and he's more than let it go to his head.
Can I bring one issue? One of the issues that people would like Virginia to address is the minimum wage. Virginia has a $7.25 minimum wage, which is the same as the federal wage, which hasn't changed since 2009. There's people who support changing it think that's one of the things you guys should have on your agenda if you got control of the legislature. Others say the state just got named the best place in the country to do business, according to CNBC, and that something like that would undermine the state's business atmosphere.
Well, first off, one of the reasons we got named as one of the best places for business, or the best place, is because we have an inclusive and diversified economy, a good education system, moving to training workers more and more for the jobs of the future, and we invest. Now, in terms of minimum wage, right now the minimum wage, you said, was $7.25. That's only 26.1% of what a living wage is for a family of four in Virginia.
$15,000 a year.
Yeah, that's not enough. It's not enough, and it needs to be higher. I'd like to see us move towards $15 an hour. If people want to talk about regional adjustments, that's one thing, but I prefer to see $15 an hour for the workers at large.
Adam Eben is a member of the Virginia Senate, where he represents parts of Alexandria, Arlington, and Fairfax counties. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks,
I'm Mark Fisher from the Washington Post, sitting in for Kodjo Namdi. Tom Sherwood and I will be back after a break with Jack Wilson, the chair of the Virginia Republican Party, to get back on that gun issue. That's coming up in a moment. Welcome back to the Politics Hour. I'm Mark Fisher, sitting in for Kodjo, here with Tom Sherwood, our resident analyst and contributing writer for Washington City Paper. And we'll continue our discussion of the rather short legislative special session in Virginia to talk about gun policy. And we're joined now by Jack Wilson, chair of the Virginia Republican Party. Welcome.
Good afternoon. Good to be with you.
Good afternoon. Are you calling us from Chesterfield County?
I sure am.
Okay. Uh-huh.
And so, Jack Wilson, you may have heard Senator Adam Eben talking about how the Democrats felt somewhat betrayed by their Republican colleagues. They thought there was going to be a legitimate, straightforward debate on guns, and in fact, there was no debate of any kind. Why was it important to pull the plug on this special session rather than actually hash out some of these issues?
Well, first of all, it was clear that Governor Northam's call for the special session was just a political stunt. It was a ham-fisted attempt to, to leverage off the tragedy in Virginia Beach to do an end around and do what he could to infringe on Second Amendment rights, and call this special session. I mean, he called it 4 days after the tragedy. Memorials and burials hadn't even occurred, and yet he's calling for a special session to infringe on Second Amendment rights. But what the senator failed to mention to your audience was, while the special session was shortened, what the speaker and Senate Majority Leader did was refer all the legislation to the Crime Commission for study and an analysis of the various pieces of legislation and how they might have impacted or had an effect on the Virginia Beach shooting. That was analogous to what then-Governor Kaine did after the Virginia Tech shooting, where he appointed a Blue Ribbon Commission to study that disaster and then figure out specific solutions. It's what Speaker Cox did after the Parkland shooting in Florida, created a school safety commission to look at specific issues that could improve school safety. That's where you have a policy-driven approach to these issues as opposed to a political-driven approach, and that's what the governor did.
What is the Virginia Crime Commission? Is that a place where things go to die, or does it have a demonstrated record of proposing things that this legislature should do? What is the Virginia Crime Commission?
It's an existing commission, bipartisan, that looks at specific crime issues analyzes specific legislative proposals, comes forward with recommendations for legislation. And so with the speaker, it's an existing commission. This wasn't something that was created during the special session. It's a standing commission that looks at crime-related issues. And what the Senate Majority Leader and the Speaker recognized was this is the body that can take a look at the investigation of the Virginia Beach tragedy, look at the specific legislative proposals that came out in the General Assembly special session, and then report back prior to the reconvened session in November. So it's a more policy approach than the political approach.
We're talking with Jack Wilson, chair of the Virginia Republican Party, and we have an email from Catherine who says, I've been proud to have voted for good Republicans most of my life, but the events from Virginia are just the latest in a horrifying stream that show this once respectable party is no longer conservative. They are radical, turning their backs on tradition and even moral values in order to maintain their power. It breaks my heart. Jack Wilson, are you concerned at all that how Republicans' actions on guns might affect this November's election?
No, actually, I think the, again, as I mentioned, I think the recognition that the governor's approach was purely political helps energize our Republican base going into this November. You couple that with the right to life issue that played out during the regular session of the General Assembly and Delegate Trans Bill. Our Republican base is as energized as I've seen it to make sure that the General Assembly stays in Republican hands, because they can see what would happen with Democrat control of both houses of the General Assembly with a Democrat governor ready to sign anything that comes his way. I mean, essentially, you know, I did listen to the senator and talk about some of those quick things that they would like to do on gun control, but the reality is the Democrat Party in Virginia would pass gun regulations that would mirror what's going on in New York, Chicago, and you know, District of Columbia, none of which have done anything to improve the safety of those citizens. But if the Democrats control the General Assembly, those types of regulations and laws will be passed, and that would be a real detriment to the Commonwealth. And so I think our voters see that and will come out to support Republicans who support the Second Amendment.
I mentioned you work and live in Chesterfield County, which is a very large county outside of the city of Richmond. Is there any gun legislation that as you would support as an individual, anything that could be put on the books about guns, or is this just a huge divide between the two parties?
Well, no, I think, again, there is an opportunity for an honest discussion on things that could actually solve the problems that have been created. Clearly, a primary focus dealing with the gun violence has to be on the mental health side of the equation. The governor was pretty candid in his discussion of the special session that none of the proposals that he was putting forth would have even stopped the Virginia Beach shooting. So I think there needs to be a much more logical and policy-driven approach to the issue rather than the political approach. And so there may be issues that focus on mental health, enhanced penalties for violent crime with guns. The Democrats want to stay away from minimum sentences, but those have been proven effective in other areas. And so perhaps that can be the focus. The reality is that law-abiding, concealed carry permit Virginians are one of the safest, lowest crime generators in the Commonwealth. And so we shouldn't be targeting those people. We need to be targeting the people that are going to break the law.
Let's hear from David in Fairfax. David, you're on the air.
Hi. That law-abiding, concealed carry...
Hello,
can you hear me?
Quickly, please. We have a little time.
Yeah, I'm sorry. I just want to say that there's tons and tons of research done on gun control. There's a lot of other countries that have enacted laws. There's a lot of other places that have already researched it. The idea that you put that aside to be restudied seems a little ridiculous and a little bit of, well, really a political move in itself.
Jack Wilson?
Well, the reality is violence is an evil that we face, and whether it's with guns or knives or hammers or anything else, we need to focus on that issue. Law-abiding gun owners are one of the safest bodies that we have in the Commonwealth. It's the focus on those that would commit violence. And I go back to the examples of Chicago and New York, which have some of the strictest gun control laws in the country, yet some of the highest murder rates in the country. So you can't say that gun control is going to stop the violence. Again, it's sort of cliche. If you outlaw guns, only outlaws will have guns.
I think one of the Republican members, might have been the House Majority Leader, proposed allowing localities, that is, local governments in the state, to ban guns in their courthouses and official places of government work. That's one of the bills, I think, that was passed. Mr. Norman, I believe. Is that something you would support?
Well, no. Senator Norman proposed the bill, and it was quickly shot down by some of his Senate colleagues. I think Senator Norman, the majority leader, recognized he may have been a little Machiavellian in it, as he said in his submittal of that bill. But the reality is one of the survivors of one of the victims at Virginia Beach has recounted that she had concerns about her safety and had considered taking, and she was a concealed carry permit, she had considered taking her weapon, her firearm, to work to protect herself, but because the rules wouldn't allow it, she didn't have it with her when she needed it. So I think, you know, we have to look at the safety of public buildings, and perhaps enhanced security is where we need to go. But we need to look at them in a much more reasoned policy approach, not just throw it out there as political theater in an attempt to game the political environment heading into November, which is what the governor did.
We're going to have to leave it there. Jack Wilson, chair of Virginia's Republican Party, thanks so much for joining us.
Glad to be with you.
And Tom Sherwood, resident analyst and contributing writer for Washington City Paper.
Everyone have
a
good weekend.
Okay. Today's Politics Hour was produced by Mark Gunnery. Coming up Monday, it'll be your turn. Kojo will be opening up the phone lines and taking your calls, tweets, and emails to talk about whatever's on your mind. Tell us what's sparking debate in your office or at the neighborhood pool this summer. We want to hear from you. That will all start on Monday at noon. I'm Mark Fisher from The Washington Post, sitting in for Kojo Nambi, and he'll be back next week with more of these important local political issues, along with the great Tom Sherwood. Until then, thanks for listening.
The Kojo Nambi Show is produced by Ruth Tam, Mark Gunnery, Margaret Barthel, Sydney Grannon, and Maura Curry. Our managing producer is Angelisa Schrobstorf. Our senior producer is Mona Kashvi. Our engineer is Ben Privett, and our intern is Kayla Hewitt. For past shows and more content, visit kojoshow.org.